Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Fiji is tackling an apparent spike in cases of child sexual and physical abuse as doctors call for more child psychologists to help victims. Police release figures that show that there were over 2,500 reported cases of sexual assault in 2015. A doctor and reporter for the Ministry of Health, Rati Matakaka, says the higher number of cases doesn't mean there's a recent phenomenon, but that people are more confident in coming forward in reporting cases. She spoke to Alex Perrottet.
So just in the last few years, we've started to protect them, and that's when the numbers have sort of started coming in, giving us a sort of a truer reflection of what's actually happening out there. And yeah, so that's what we're seeing, that most of them come from those kind of broken families, you know, being looked after by other family members or friends. And that's the thing that social welfare is doing now, is trying to alleviate the factors that we have already identified, such as unemployment for the family, like the parents are not there most of the time, or because they're trying to make a living and then someone else comes in to look after them. So we've come up with child protection allowances, which helps with, it gives the family some allowances for the child's food, living expenses, if they can't earn enough money for the child and they're usually away looking for a job.
We've got cases where parents have been found to be guilty in the sexual abuse of their children. I mean, so surely there has to be some more basic level of education and awareness here. And I think we've got the minister herself, Rosie Akbar, warning parents and guardians that the government won't hesitate to take negligent parents to task. Do you know any more about what the ministry's planning to do there?
In regards of prevention, trying to prevent it, I am aware that they're actually trying to introduce sort of good parenting classes for young parents, and also trying to introduce this also into high school, towards the higher levels of high school. That's the two programs that I'm aware that's coming out soon. But to the acute problem, I just know of the child helpline that they're doing. And they're also trying to involve the Itauke affairs to try and get the message out to the communities. It's a bit difficult tackling the squatter areas because there's no structure to the community. Like in a typical Fijian village, you would have like the Turanganikoro, where you would go and then, ask them permission to talk to the community. And then, the hall and everywhere where you go, and then the information gets through to everybody. But in the squatters, it's sort of different because there's no clear structure of who's, the community leader and everything else. So I think that's a big barrier to trying to get the information through to those sort of settlements. But I know that they are trying to work through there by getting community health from our side, community health workers to come in.
You're a doctor, you see cases day to day. I mean, what sort of reaction in general do you get from the children? I mean, when something so devastating as this happens, is there a complete loss of trust in the family? Are they afraid to go back? How do you deal with those more problematic cases?
There's a big big gap that we have here in Fiji, and I'm hoping that this is something that we can direct our efforts to in this year, in the coming years, is having some sort of counseling for the children that are involved. We have a lot of counselors in Fiji, but unfortunately there's no child psychologist or even a psychiatrist that's employed by the ministry, both in the Ministry of Health and the Ministry for Women. So these children, they get counseled by general counselors, but in regards to, how they cope, how they live. But having worked in Australia and looked at the resources that they put in into counseling, I recognize that it's a really big area, and a lot of our children that have been abused are traumatized for life. The most severe case that I've had, I've seen her again, and unfortunately she was also physically abused in addition to being sexually abused. So she had mentally regressed. So she was a class 5 student, but by the time I saw her a year later, she had a developmental age of a class 1 student, because she was physically abused also. But in regards to all the other children, there is a general distrust, but I think the main factor that plays a very big role is the family where that child is from. if it's the parents are quite solid and they have a very close relationship, those are the ones that I see that do quite well when we see at follow-up. But all of them would actually benefit from a child psychologist being in the picture and from child counselors being part of the whole rehabilitative part of abuse. Eh?
And that's a message you're sending to the Ministry of Health, that would be a good move for the future to bring in child psychologists or psychiatrists to participate in this effort?
Yes, and I've been saying that, and I'm actually trying to have a collaboration between the Ministry of Social Welfare and the Health to try and get in a child psychologist as part of our child protection training this year. We usually hold a 3-day training for all doctors around Fiji, so I'm trying to get a child psychologist that I worked with in Sydney to come over also as part of this training. Just to include the social welfare people into it also, to see the huge role that a psychologist can play in parts of management of these cases.
The Papua New Guinea Association of Australia has proposed a community centre for Pacific nations. The idea that such a centre could be housed in the former Australian School of Pacific Administration, or ASOPA, building at Middlehead in Sydney. The association's president, Andrea Williams, says the site is ideal since ASOPA played a close role in developing PNG for nationhood, and its direct successors became leading Pacific Development Training Institute for the last 51 years. She spoke to Johnny Blades.
I guess we feel that it would be an opportunity to refocus on the relationships between Australia and Pacific Islands. As far as I know, I feel, there are many Papua New Guineans who know a lot about Australian history, our shared connection over the years, but ask many Australians and they probably wouldn't. So it's about acknowledging Australia's role in Papua New Guinea, in the Pacific, and trying to grow awareness about that and connections.
What would you envisage the practical day-to-day activities of such a centre to be?
Well, we'd like to see a suitable living, interactive tribute in the form of, let's call it, an Australian Community Centre for Pacific Nations. It would be a focal point for the Australian-Pacific relationship, which could engage with communities in cultural, educational and resources, so that people have a place to go to find out perhaps more about the Pacific, who can, you might have community groups going there and sharing their culture with Australians. For instance, we had an art show last year celebrating the 40th anniversary of Papua New Guinea independence, and we tried to get Papua New Guineans down to Australia for that, and that was a little bit fraught because of the visa issues. But having, say, art workshops, writers' workshops, we're involved with the Crocodile Prize in Papua New Guinea, having workshops that integrate Pacific Islanders and Australians, where we can both share and develop ideas and have a more cohesive future, I guess.
We've seen recently a couple of fairly high-profile Australians sort of lament the lack of understanding in Australia about Pacific neighbours, particularly Papua New Guinea. I mean, Sean Dorney commenting with his latest book that, really Australians should know more, and the government, at least, they're not tapping into that considerable expertise of the former KIAPs and the people you mentioned before about PNG.
That's right. And, one of the things to remember is that there were many prominent Australians, Papua New Guineans and others, who had really distinguished careers in shaping the development in Papua New Guinea and across the Pacific region, and guiding Papua New Guinea to nationhood even.
People-to-people engagement has always been important, hasn't it, with Australia and the Pacific neighbours? You can't wait around for government all these times, can you? It's got to
That's
be people-led.
Right, yes, it has to be people-led, I think, and there's a lot of NGOs, and I guess we're hoping that our proposal will get up, and then we'd have to, we'd be looking at playing a coordinating role with a wider group of organisations with similar objectives. So really it needs to be a centre that engages the people of Australia and the Pacific, a community centre for everybody.
A Papua New Guinea opposition MP says the Prime Minister is prepared to vandalise the constitution to build his personal wealth while the country is being brought to its knees. Biden Nama's comments come as Peter O'Neill ignores calls to shut down the Manus Island asylum camp after the Supreme Court challenge. brought by Mr. Namaha declared the arrangement for the Australian-run operations were illegal. He told Don Wiseman that Mr. O'Neill must step down to allow a police investigation into his possible involvement in an alleged fraud involving a Port Moresby law firm.
If Peter O'Neill wants to say that he's innocent, he should be going down to the police, get himself interviewed, and he can go and defend himself in the proper court of law. But right now what he is doing is avoiding being arrested by police, being interviewed by fraud squad. He's shutting down the fraud squad office. That is uncalled for as the Prime Minister of this country to do such actions.
Do you think he should step aside right now at this point and then go through this process?
He should step aside. A right-thinking Prime Minister should do the right thing. That is, step aside and allow investigations to go ahead.
Now, one of your key concerns besides the state of the economy is what's happened on Manus Island. And it was you that brought the Supreme Court challenge and you were successful with that. What is it you actually want the Prime Minister to do? Because he has said that he will shut it down, hasn't he?
Well, what the Prime Minister falls short of doing, instead of saying that he will shut it down, is to let the country know of what is his schedule. We need to know the time frame. The time frame as to when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and the nation needs to know.
What sort of a time frame are you looking at?
I'm looking at, you know, happening within the next 3 months. They should be able to do that. When they occupied Manus Island, it happened so fast.
Why 3 months, though? Why can't it happen tomorrow?
No, basically, I'm giving them a time frame of 3 months. But the shutting down, it should shut down already, as soon as the court decision was handed down, immediate. It is of immediate effect. But 3 months, as in, you know, demobilization and all these things must happen. And I would like to allow that to happen. In terms of shutting it down, it should have happened on the day the Supreme Court handed down its decision.
What do you think has got to happen with the asylum seekers and the refugees? Because it doesn't look as though PNG is in a position to take them, and I don't think they want to be in PNG.
Primarily, the issue of asylum seekers is Australia's problem. It's Australia's issue. And Australia should have processed them in Australia and then deal with it. But instead, they decided to choose a third country. It happened to be Papua New Guinea, by which I have successfully contested and successfully won the case. So it is up to Australia now to sort this problem out. And they cannot say, oh, it's no longer our problem. That's not right. That's not true.
Of course, there are a series of issues that you have attacked the government on. You say that the opposition's done all it can to defend the Constitution, that now the people have got to take the country back. What are you saying? Are you suggesting a revolution here?
I'm not suggesting a revolution. I'm suggesting that if Prime Minister continues to suppress and intimidate the police force, especially the fraud and anti-corruption, what solution do we have? The students are already boycotting classes. What solution is there? The right thing for a right-thinking Prime Minister to do by protecting the integrity of the office of the Prime Minister of the independent state of Papua New Guinea is to step aside and allow the police process to take place.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The main care provider for victims of domestic violence in Samoa says its activities are limited by the lack of funding. The Samoan Victim Support Group provides care for victims of violence, as well as rehabilitation training, such as anger management courses and couples counseling. Its president, Mugala Tele Salili Lin Chang, says the organization has so far relied on the community's generosity and donations. But he told Corey Hawkins growing demand is making it harder for them to keep all the programs going.
Ever since our family violence court and our family court has been set up in Samoa, over 400 men have gone through the advocacy training where our trainers do the training, as well as the pastors and the reverends and the priests of Samoa are involved in. They help us in facilitating the training. These main offenders, they are referred from the family violence court or from the family court, so that they would be able to attend these programs, not only on anger management, but also it involves liquor, and also involves couple counseling and involves stress inside families. So it's everything to do with families. It's a holistic approach in helping our people within families.
And the focus is on behavioral reform and keeping families together, is it?
Yes, that's the main focus. That's why we work around families, is that it's about the behavior. It's about bringing families back together. It's about understanding each other, because sometimes when they're angry, they don't know what they're saying, very abusive. So that's why. So instead of just sending them immediately to prison, they go for these programs and see how things will come back into their families. So it's been good, and a lot of families have come back together on it. And for the first year of 127 men that came for this program, only one reoffended, but that reoffended was not on the same case as was how he was brought to the program.
Once they've graduated, do you continue working with them? Is there a continuation of your program?
Yes, we do that. Remember, Inside Villages Victim Support has a pool of village representatives. And Inside Villages, that's where the pastors are involved, the church is involved, our village reps are involved. And for anything else that is much needed for them, or if there's anything, anger that arises, but they will immediately contact us. And it's been happening for the 3 years now. So we always keep monitor. We know that what's happening inside this family, so we know that. But sometimes we bring in the couple, and then we counsel the couple if there's always, but they will still ask for help if they know that there's more help that they need.
What are some of the ongoing challenges or difficulties that you feel still need to be addressed, or what could be done to improve your program in your view?
Because this. The program is not funded, so we have to use any means that we can to help them to make this a reality. And also a struggle for us as well, trying to find donors so that they will be able to help us in what we are doing. So with the help of the community coming together, we embrace the fellowship with the pastors and the churches. So that's how we are able to get facilitators, so that, you know, like, and counselors as well. So everybody is taking up the responsibility, and we all come together to help each other. It's not only for the men as well. We also run the program for women from the court. But yes, that's the biggest challenge, is that we will have to we just have to get funding, because most of these people do not live in town, so they're quite far. And at the same time, to have this program work, we also deal with the employers, so that these people will have their hours, their time out, so that they will be able to attend the program. So there's a lot of writings, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of reporting, and going back to court as well.
And your vision, as president, your vision for this, where do you want it to go? What is the ultimate goal for you?
I want to see that it gets less and less inside court. I want to see the success of it. What we're doing is that we're creating a peaceful environment and having our men educated. The vision is that fewer people will attend the program.
The Pacific region's community groups plan to push for reform of the humanitarian aid system at the World Summit in Turkey next week. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has convened the first World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul in response to high levels of human suffering around the world. The Executive Director of the Pacific Islands Association for Non-Governmental Groups, Emil Duretamaga, is among the civil society groups attending from the Pacific. She told Sally Round, "It will be a platform for Pacific Islanders to tell the world about humanity challenges they face."
There is a lot of discussion in the world about the Syria situation, what's going on in Europe, and I think many people don't really know that we are facing our own humanitarian challenges to do with climate crises. Also, I am hopeful for the recognition of the specific role of civil society and support for local and national leadership, which is something that's been discussed time and again, but this would also mean a slight reform of the UN humanitarian system, which is very much a global system that hasn't, in my view, to date responded well to strengthening local leadership. Because, you know, the first response is always the local response. At the moment, there's a lot of global response, which brings in external resources, which is great, but it tends to swamp and overwhelm our local systems. And I think the important issue is also about community resilience.
Did you see that gap, particularly after Cyclone Winston?
Oh, absolutely. This was a major issue with TC Pam in Vanuatu. We also saw this with TC Winston because we were directly involved. So Piango is a regional organization. We have a presence at the national level in 21 countries and territories. And so this is a big issue that has come up now, the whole localization of aid, the recognition of support for local communities who are linked in with national civil society. And so we see a pattern where there's a lot of support for international organizations, international NGOs, but very little support for local NGOs and local communities.
But doesn't that filter through to the local NGOs in the end?
What filters through is very little. I mean, what we've seen since TC Pam and TC Winston is international NGOs setting up, expanding their organizations, and local NGOs are still struggling on shoestring. Now, that's not to say it's an either-or. What we're saying is that there needs to be a strengthening of local and national NGOs particularly. The challenge for a lot of local NGOs is national coordination. So when a disaster strikes, of course, the government is the lead actor, and that the government usually pulls and coordinates everything. But the government has also recognized that they're not able to do this at a scale, particularly that we saw here with Winston. And they require and appreciate the role of NGOs. But unless NGOs at the national and local level are coordinated, you have a lot of duplication. You have a lot of actors going in, doing similar things.
What about other humanitarian issues in the region? Will you be bringing those to the table?
Yes, well, certainly. You know, the issue of the vulnerability of women and children. I mean, when we look at the people with disabilities, what are the other challenges? Financing, the issue of climate change and how that links to the kind of humanitarian challenges. What is particularly important here in Istanbul is the opportunity to tell the world the nature of humanitarian challenges that we are facing in the Pacific. I know I've been to many global meetings where people don't know the Pacific exists. They don't even know that, we're suffering from these climate crises on the front line, as we call it.
But what can a summit like this realistically achieve?
Well, certainly a summit like this, particularly convened by the United Nations Secretary General, identifies what the priorities are. Development partners, international community will tend to realign, reallocate resources according to priorities. We're not going to Istanbul and expecting Istanbul to come up with solutions for the Pacific. We're going to Istanbul with our Pacific priorities. We've also got ideas about how we need to work better together. But Istanbul will just be a platform and a stage for us to put the Pacific on the global map and in the United Nations.
Something like this must cost a lot of money. Wouldn't that money be better sent to covering a humanitarian crisis?
Oh, well, absolutely. Yes, that's what we in civil society are often saying. What difference does such global conferences at this scale? The first thing to say is that, you know, it's the first time there will be a UN summit of this nature, and certainly we could do with a lot of the resources instead of going to Istanbul. But you know, that's something that the United Nations have to address. Here in the Pacific, we are beginning to question ourselves the value of going to such large-scale global meetings, and, you know, how does that benefit? The reality, though, Sally, is that, you know, we don't have enough resources in the Pacific to solve all our problems, and so we need to influence global decision-makers in order to reallocate and redistribute finances that are much needed in the Pacific.
And finally, New Zealand television sports news and drama is starting to be relayed through public broadcasters in the Pacific as part of the New Zealand government initiative. The broadcasters will be able to draw down content from a so-called warehouse of publicly funded New Zealand programs. New Zealand's Pacific Economic Ambassador Shane Jones launched the initiative last week in Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. He spoke to Sally Round.
It's an attempt on our part to improve the offerings, to provide both information, entertainment material and knowledge about New Zealand to further broaden and deepen our footprint amongst our Pacific neighbours.
I understand that New Zealand is contributing, what, $400,000 to this?
Well, the government used to give money to Television New Zealand. That money has now been redirected to meeting the costs associated with providing this content. And, of course, the asset is on the Pacific broadcasters themselves to draw down the content as their schedule allows. But the various tele stations up in Port Moresby were very enthusiastic. The broadcasting bureaucrats were very enthusiastic. Not surprisingly, the young people are as keen as mustard on viewing sport. There is some rugby, there's some soccer and a variety of other sports. There are ongoing challenges working with both the staff and training the next generation of Pacific broadcasters. There's a lot of enthusiasm to have some of our senior broadcasting semi-retired folk maybe or current professionals to go up there and work with them. And at the moment, we do have a number of Pacific media graduates or students coming down to New Zealand. They work in various media outlets and take that knowledge back up home.
So a bit of a two-pronged approach here, that a bit of soft diplomacy and some training as well for the local people in the Pacific Islands?
It's a part of the quiver of diplomatic arrows that we have in the Pacific. There's a demand for it. We've got the material. I've been amazed by the enthusiasm from a whole range of people to actually make it work.
You say some news and current affairs is going in there?
Yes, Parliament TV at various times will be available. New Zealand current affairs shows, New Zealand news. The other area that people have expressed an interest in receiving the material has been those people catering for tourists. I think this New Zealand content is going to increase both the offerings, which will be valuable as part of their broadcasting sector, but also good for visitors. But the key point is that we're looking to have a broad coverage at this stage, not stretching into Micronesia, but certainly Melanesia and amongst our Polynesian neighbours.
And given the demise of Australian broadcasting in the region, is this a bit of an effort to sort of fill the gap there?
Well, that observation has been loudly and colourfully made by professional broadcasters in the Pacific, which I think partly explains their enthusiasm for the content.
Which of the programming do you think is going to be the most popular? Is it going to be the rugby?
The reality is a lot of the young people, like in Papua New Guinea, after we had spoken, they were very focused on sport, etc. But they like the notion that there's hunting shows, fishing shows. There'll be an option for the public broadcasters to fill up their schedule with a variety of content. Kiwi drama, Kiwi kids entertainment programs, sport, current affairs, snippets of Parliament, Māori TV. So there's a variety that should give an accurate description of New Zealand insights, lifestyle choices, as is shown through our publicly funded broadcasting material.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days. Bye-bye.